of citizenship in this framing, and it's saying they're not citizens. Dred Scott was the one that said that a black man has no rights that a white man is bound to respect. Dred Scott, in fact, did not stop the crisis. In fact, it added to it, and it helped lead to the Civil War. After the Civil War, you had Andrew Johnson as the president of the United States, basically issuing these mass amnesties to the Confederacy, to Confederate leaders, who then reassumed their positions in these states. And they passed constitutions and laws that denied black people their rights. One of the laws that they passed were the Black Codes. The Black Codes, among other things, besides trying to control labor, the Black Code said that black people could not bear arms. They could not have weapons, and that they needed to be disarmed. You had the rise of these paramilitary groups working in league with these neo-Confederate states, trying to disarm black people. You had a bloody massacre, one right after the next. There's a travelogue of carnage by Carl Schurz, who writes on the report of the conditions in the South that is just harrowing. Historian and legal scholar Annette Gordon Reed calls it a slow motion.
You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming online at KBOO.FM.
Want an impactful way to volunteer for KBOO? Believe in KBOO's values of peace, justice, democracy, human rights, multiculturalism, environmentalism, freedom of expression, and social change? Then apply to be a member of the KBOO Board of Directors. Our KBOO board guides our strategic work and represents the interests and visions of all our members. There is a time commitment of about 15 hours a month for all board members, and you must be a KBOO member. To apply, go to KBOO.fm and fill out an application. If you need a paper copy mailed to you, call the station or email applicationboard@kboo.org. That's one word, applicationboard@kboo.org. The deadline to apply is July 25th, 2021.
Did you miss the Soul and Hip Hop Marathon on Juneteenth weekend? No worries. You can go to kboo.fm/soul2021 to listen to the archive show. You can also snag a limited edition soul and hip hop t-shirt before July 7th to show your support for the music and programming you love. Again, you can catch the Soul and Hip Hop Marathon and snag a limited edition t-shirt at
KBOO.FM/soul2021. Joining us, you are listening to Divided States, stories of efforts to pull together when things fall apart. I'm Shirley Jihad. Much of the nation is reopening this summer, but in the midst of the pandemic, with so many people isolated, alone, often scrolling for hours online, misinformation spread like another kind of dangerous contagion. Belief in the far-right conspiracy QAnon took hold and shot up. It showed up in force with the storming of the Capitol. QAnon also hit close to home and cut families apart, leaving a lot of people wondering, what do you do if your loved one believes in something that just isn't true and it takes over their lives? How do you pull them back? Dan DeWald says he lost his parents to QAnon and is struggling to stay connected with them. On his recent visit with his mom in North Dakota, she admonishes him for getting vaccinated. That's when things fall apart.
with like the greatest conviction in her eyes. She said, "Daniel, they reprogram your DNA." And I just said, "That's not how it works, Mom." But, you know, it wasn't going to go anywhere from there.
So DeWald goes for a walk with his mom, again trying to connect with her, but he sees things unravel further.
And I looked her in the eyes, and she was truly, deeply angry and just like laser eyes with focus. She was so intent. You could just see like her heart was racing a trillion beats a minute, and she was upset and angry and deeply offended. Outraged is probably a better word, that I didn't agree with what she's saying. It ended unresolved. And it's still unresolved, and the hostility is there every day.
QAnon has gained followers steadily since its emergence in 2017. Because there's no official membership, though, it's hard to gauge just how many people believe in it. Some estimates track it in the millions. The fringe movement asserts a variety of conspiracy theories. You've probably heard some of them. There's a deep state government or child sex rings involving Democratic leaders and celebrities. The group is also focused on COVID, questioning the virus's existence and whether it was created in a lab, or even whether the virus vaccine is meant to microchip its patients. A quick search online shows a lot of people are reeling after family members get sucked into QAnon. One group on Reddit is called QAnon Casualties. Titles on those posts tell you a lot about grief and loss, kids worried about parents, couples facing divorce, many other people struggling just to cope, all stemming from QAnon.
Out of nowhere, my QAnon parents called me to tell me that they're done with me.
I lost my whole family to Q, and they hardly realized it. Their stupidity almost killed my grandpa.
I lost my husband. Son next?
Divorce after 35 years. My life was perfect till my husband got involved with this cult.
USC professor Errol Southers is a former special agent for the FBI, an expert in far-right extremist groups.
COVID-19 and the stay-at-home orders became what I call the extremist ideological trifecta.
And he says QAnon is an extremist group supercharged by the pandemic.
When you've got a QAnon adherent who already believes that there is a government conspiracy driven by a cabal or by some elites, to be told to stay at home because of a virus you don't believe in and have to wear a mask is a perfect environment.
Professor Southers says the level of radicalization he sees in QAnon supporters is similar to what he sees in other extremist groups. And in this case, he says, with former President Trump fanning the flames.
When I say radicalized, there's three components to that for me. It's a person who identifies with the ideology, embraces the ideology, and then is willing to further the ideology. So these people, with all due respect, are no less radicalized than someone who's in a terrorist organization.
A lot of family members say they doubt their loved one would become some kind of terrorist. Still, they say they do feel the effects of QAnon on a deeply personal level. It's about the sadness, the loss, the feeling of being unable to connect with family members who have become QAnon faithful, as Dan DeWald explains.
It makes me feel embarrassed, and to say it out loud just makes you feel ridiculous. Like Bill Gates is trying to microchip me. Well, most people can laugh that off, but my parents literally believe that.
In their desperation, some family members have tried to connect with experts who have experienced deprogramming cult members.
I was working with a family, and their daughter was talking about the storm. I hadn't heard that term yet, and I didn't know what that was about. And I said, you know, can I talk to her about what she means? Because the family was very alarmed.
Dr. Rachel Bernstein is a licensed therapist who has a lot of experience working with people in cults. She talked to the woman who believed in the storm when QAnon faithful say some politicians will be nabbed and arrested for treason or child trafficking.
And I was expecting just to have kind of a conversation where I could ask her what this is, and the vitriol and the personal attacks on me, even though we had never spoken, about how stupid I was and how I'm part of the sheeple and I must be a part of the cannibalist cabal. As she's talking, I'm thinking, okay, okay, got it.
As crazy as some of the ideas may seem, Dr. Bernstein tells clients to try and avoid fighting or getting into debates with the person.
Don't argue with them point by point, fact by fact. because you're going to be arguing with people who don't have facts. They think they do. And so all of your facts, if they're truthful, are going to seem wrong. It's like opposite day.
Bernstein says the best way to talk with QAnon believers is not by arguing with them, but by instead acknowledging some part of what they say. She remembers one young woman.
She was sure, you know, there are all these child trafficking and sex rings, and QAnon was going to be protecting the children. I remember saying to this woman, I love that you care. I love that you care about kids, and this world would be a better place if more people cared the way you care.
Then Bernstein gives the woman the numbers for organizations that actually do assist exploited children.
I said I didn't need to be right and she didn't need to be wrong. I just wanted her to research the numbers and to call organizations that really do help missing and exploited children to find out how many of the cases they've solved have been helped by QAnon. When they would laugh at the other end of the line over and over, she got the message. These are difficult. These are really difficult cases because the people who I see are so wired and wound up, like spring-loaded, and it's hard for them to even sit long enough to have a conversation. So it's not always as successful immediately as the other cases that I do, unfortunately.
USC's Errol Southers says another way to deprogram radical believers is by having former members share their stories, their realizations after getting out of the group. Still, he says QAnon is not going to magically disappear overnight.
At this point, the best we can hope for is containment and some kind of management, if you will. It's no different than terrorism. Terrorism is never going to go away. We can contain it. We can reduce the risk of it happening, but it's never going to be gone. QAnon, as an extremist ideology, is here to stay.
For DeWald, despite his rocky relationship with his parents, he says he still feels a responsibility to stay in touch with them.
I will continuously try to get through to her on the principle of trying to help out my family member. I sort of use a parallel where if you have somebody who has a substance abuse problem, it's almost never a good idea to completely cut them off. If you just say, okay, that person's crazy, there's no helping them, it usually does end quite poorly. That's not my parents. In their case, it's this conspiracy theory cult they're involved in, and I find it to be irresponsible to completely turn a blind eye to it.
The methods to deal with QAnon are still unfolding and being developed. In the meantime, people like Dan DeWald are struggling with how to move forward and help family members. Psychologists struggling to help deprogram one person at a time are looking for ways to scale up their efforts in the face of this new kind of outbreak that surfaced in the shadow of the pandemic. I'm Shirley Jihad. Daniel Green was our reporter and producer for this story. You're listening to Divided States, efforts to pull together when things fall apart. Another issue bubbling up is a fight over stories, over what kind of history and whose history is taught in schools. This is playing out loudly in more conservative media outlets.
Critical race theory is here to ultimately destroy the economy, right? Critical race theory doesn't want an economy that runs on capitalism and free markets and freedom of choice and all of those things and human ingenuity. It wants giant systems of socialism and Marxism.
All students would be taught if their ethnicity makes them a victim or an oppressor.
When you promote a theory of hate that specifically targets a particular group of people, i.e. being white, that is a discussion and affects every American in this country.
In states across the country now, Republican leaders are pushing proposals to ban the teaching of critical race theory in schools. Several states already approved those bans. It may sound like a new line in an old story, like book burning 2.0. California, on the other hand, recently approved an effort to bring more ethnic studies into more classrooms. Johnny Dorsal explains how that effort has its own twisty history.
The California State Board of Education is doing something that has never been done before. I move that we adopt the ethnic studies model curriculum draft.
We'll take a roll call vote.
Don't let the mundane nature of this vote fool you. California just became the first state to have an ethnic studies curriculum available for all its K-12 students.
Motion carries unanimously.
It took several years and four different versions to reach this agreement. The result could change how future generations understand history, specifically the history of people of color. This is not a mandatory curriculum, at least not yet. But if it does become a school requirement, California could be the catalyst that motivates the rest of the country to shape whose history is taught and how. But a few states are going in the opposite direction. Republican leaders in some states have been moving to ban critical race theory, raising the issue as a new battle in the culture wars. For now, the California decision will likely impact students such as Kaylin Perez.
I am in eighth grade and I am 14 years old.
She is getting ready to enter high school here in Los Angeles. I recently quizzed her to get some insight into what kind of cultural history she's learned up to this point.
Do you know anything about the incarceration of Japanese Americans during World War II?
Actually, no, I really don't know anything.
Okay. What can you tell me about Cesar Chavez?
Well, I just know that he was a person who helped people. I think something about a strike.
Can you tell me about Frederick Douglass?
Another name.
I'm not gonna lie, I definitely couldn't answer any of those questions when I was in eighth grade. It makes me wonder, whose history are we learning in school anyway? I mean, I remember being told about Martin Luther King Jr. and Malcolm X, but growing up on the East Coast, I never learned anything about Cesar Chavez. In fact, I can't even recall ever learning anything about the treatment of Japanese Americans during World War II. And other than the history of Christopher Columbus, I honestly can't remember hearing much about Native Americans either.
It would feel very welcoming to people who are coming from other countries or, you know, aren't born here to learn about their cultural traditions or history. Personally, I'm Hispanic, so I would definitely love to learn more about my culture and Mexico. But sadly, I feel like we're more focused on the American history than anything else.
The question for Kaylin, millions of students and educators in American society, is whose story is important and who gets to tell that story? That is what's at the heart of a fierce debate here in California over the ethnic studies model curriculum. Proponents feel the approved curriculum is a successful first step in bringing more stories of underrepresented people into classrooms. However, people who oppose these lesson plans range from left to right politically. Before we get into all of that, let's go back about half a century. This effort to bring more ethnic studies into schools has its own storied history. In 1968, a coalition of ethnic student groups at San Francisco State University embarked on a campus strike to rebuke the lack of diversity at the school and to demand a new curriculum that would be more representative for people of color. This group called itself the Third World Liberation Front and went on strike for 5 months, the longest strike ever by students in the U.S. The strikes were an organized coalition of students and teachers who protested by holding rallies, marches, and sit-ins on campus. In response to confrontations between students and police, the campus was briefly shut down. Once it reopened, striking students urged students not to attend classes. The strikers received a large amount of backlash, including from then-Governor of California, Ronald Reagan.
Thousands and thousands of legitimate students who want to go to school and are enrolled there have a right to go to school, and they have no right to allow a little militant minority, both of faculty and students, to close down the university and deny the others their right to the education that they're trying to get. And all it takes is the courage to stand up and take whatever action is necessary to ensure that the majority can go about their business as they obviously want to do.
But protesters didn't back down.
Now, don't ask us to understand. Don't say, well, you little colored guys or you black guys should try to go along with law and order. Law and order is not set up for us. This is the only time in the history of the United States, in the history of college institutions, where we've had a planned riot, and nobody got hurt.
This was the genesis of the pioneering work of Albert Camarillo.
So ethnic studies, as it's founded in the late 1960s, is really about what at that time called underrepresented minorities, African Americans, Latinos, Mexican Americans, Asian Americans, Native Americans.
Dr. Camarillo is a professor of American history emeritus at Stanford University and a specialist in comparative studies of race and ethnicity and the Mexican American experience in California. He says his generation, the first generation of students of color going to college, saw nothing reflecting themselves or their backgrounds in their classes.
Nothing, nada. In fact, it was all bad. And so it's my generation that said, we've got to carve out in higher education this space to understand race and ethnicity.
This effort was all based on a basic principle.
Students like to see themselves in history, see their own stories in history.
Coming up, our story takes an unexpected turn. The very people who fought so hard to develop the curriculum now fight against it.
The California Department of Education has offered a gutted, whitewashed curriculum for teachers to use as a model.
Also, just ahead, how social media unites and divides us.
Nazis doxed my address.
And how music brings us together.
We all have the same dreams, we all have the same worries, we all have the same, you know, everything in life, no matter what political, social, religious background you have.
You are listening to Divided States, efforts to pull together when things fall apart, from USC's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism. I'm Shirley Jihad. Stay with us. Thanks for joining us. You are listening to Divided States, efforts to pull together when things fall apart. I'm Shirley Jihad. Several Republican-led states around the country have moved to ban schools from teaching critical race theory. California, on the other hand, recently moved forward with plans to teach ethnic studies to children across elementary and high schools. That effort has its own storied history of twists and turns. As we continue our report, Johnny Dorsal introduces us to an early advocate of that effort.
My name is Dr. Karen Korematsu. I'm the founder and the executive director of the Fred T. Korematsu Institute in San Francisco, and the daughter of the late civil rights icon Fred Korematsu.
Dr. Korematsu has been one of the most vocal proponents for the ethnic studies model curriculum.
Prejudice is ignorance. And, you know, our most powerful weapon, actually, is education. We need to educate this generation and future generations so they can make change. I mean, unfortunately, it's going to be down to them.
Perhaps Korematsu's hope for the future generation is due to the reaction of many people in the present. The far-reaching education plan pushed by Korematsu and other advocates fell under intense scrutiny. For over 4 hours, people called into the California Board of Education session with criticisms.
Hello, my name is Lydia Person. I oppose this curriculum. The Department of Education, teachers, school, politicians have created a hostile environment for many students.
Hello, my name is Lisa Aberbach, a parent, a Californian, and daughter of Holocaust survivors. I urge you to make further changes and resist.
Hello, my name is Jaden, and I am currently a junior at LAUSD.
My name is Scott Shane.
My name is Lucina, and I'm a student at San Diego State University.
One of the callers works at San Francisco State University and actually played a key role in the original drafting of this curriculum.
Hello, my name is Lada Kiswani, and I'm a faculty member in the College of Ethnic Studies. I would just like to say that this is an insult to all the legacy of the 1968 strike veterans. That is why they oppose this curriculum, as do all writers of the original Ethnic Studies model curriculum, and experts like Cornel West and Angela Davis. As Arabs, as people of color, you've erased us, displaced us, relegated us to an appendix, then whitewashed the entire curriculum. You've allowed those who have historically benefited from racial hierarchies to define a discipline intended on eradicating racism.
Kiswani, an Arab American who's a faculty member at the San Francisco State College of Ethnic Studies, worked closely with the original writers of the model curriculum to help develop lesson plans. But then she says they felt betrayed.
So the California Department of Education has offered a gutted, whitewashed curriculum for teachers to use as a model for ethnic studies. We engaged with CDE for a year and a half. We're not getting compensated for this work. You solicit us for lessons plan, we give it to you. You ask us to meet with experts, we set up those meetings for you. You ask us to give you data, we give you that data. And still, our voices are completely erased from the curriculum, and you make changes that go against everything ethnic studies stands for, and you ice us out of the process. At some point, we have to call it.
It's important to remember, the people who condemn the model curriculum each have varying reasons as to why they disapprove.
It can uplift the racism conversation that we're having now, but doing that doesn't require polarizing students or indoctrinating them into a very specific militant ideology.
Alina Kaplan is the co-founder of Alliance for Constructive Ethnic Studies, a group fighting the original model curriculum.
It basically frames everything through this victim-oppressor lens, and instead of doing what the objective was supposed to do, which is build bridges and between communities and kind of unite and learn about each other and how can students and communities work together to confront challenges, including racism and bigotry, instead it divides people up into victims and oppressors and makes you identify yourself as one or the other.
In Kaplan's view, victimhood and elements of hatred were part of the original drafts of the ethnic studies curriculum. Conversely, the original authors of the curriculum felt that their initial drafts got so watered down as to not have any meaning.
And we felt our reputations were at stake.
Teresa Montaño, a professor at Cal State Northridge, is one of those original 21 writers. It was so bad, all of them stepped away and took their names off the plan.
This third version is when we decided to remove our names, and it was because it had moved so far from ethnic studies that it no longer was an ethnic studies curriculum. It was at best a multicultural U.S. history course. Years from now, people would blame us for what the model curriculum had become.
Montaño says people without knowledge in the field had too much influence.
We were the only ethnic studies educators that worked on this. The rest of the curriculum was decided by thousands upon thousands of public comment. No other discipline, not math, not science, not social studies, is determined by folks who don't understand their discipline. By many who are actually anti-ethnic studies, were able to contribute to constructing what ethnic studies in California would be.
Kiswani and Montaño are helping create a curriculum that they say better represents students of color. It's called the Liberated Ethnic Studies Model Curriculum Consortium. It includes about 50 educators, many of the original writers. Montaño feels this work is necessary due to the denigration of the original framework by politicians and special interest lobbyists.
What makes it even worse is not only did folks appropriate and that the California Ethnic Studies Model Curriculum become an All Lives Matter curriculum, and actually that is racist. It is racist for you to think that you can raise your voice and show your dollar bills and say, we want in on this 50-year struggle that we had very little to do with except for the last 5 minutes.
ethnic studies has obviously been a topic of debate for a long time. Ironically, in the midst of trying to figure out whose history we ought to teach in school, it seems like we are repeating history by having fights similar to those we had 50 years ago. While we are having these discussions about whose narratives should be included in history, it's important to remember what ethnic studies is really about.
The ethnic studies is much more, of course, than just learning about your cultures. It's about humanity. And we've lost that because at the end of the day, it doesn't matter what we look like or what color our skin is, we're human beings. And we all have something to offer.
Ethnic studies is in the news more and more right now, with different states considering different plans. Advocates in some states want to make it a high school requirement. Opponents in other states want it watered down or even prohibited, claiming it's a form of critical race thinking that younger students aren't ready for. This whole battle over ethnic studies itself shows how significant the fight to control the narrative really is, and the great divide over who determines the collective stories we teach about our nation's history. I'm Johnny Dorsal.
You are listening to Divided States, Efforts to Pull Together When Things Fall Apart, from USC's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism. I'm Shirley Jihad. Thanks for joining us. Like a lot of people, you may have tried something new to make the most of life at home in the pandemic lockdown, whether baking your own bread or learning a new craft or streaming video series. Millions of curious quarantiners also joined TikTok, making it the most downloaded app in the country last year. And while many people hoped their videos would go viral, in this time of cancel culture, trolling, and heightened political tensions, social media can also bring unwanted attention. Elizabeth Islas tells us about the dark side of political commentary on social media and how it can quickly manifest into real-life danger.
17-year-old Aiden Cohn Murphy knew he might get a little bit of pushback when he started talking politics on his TikTok account.
I represent Democratic, and the first time I met a Republican was in 2010.
Where he has nearly 300,000 followers.
There was a big mayoral race in the
But
primary,
9 months in, he didn't expect to be targeted by waves of white supremacists threatening to come knocking at his door.
Nazis doxed my address and told people to come and kill me. And that happened like three or four times. And it was a whole thing, and the police were here. And it was pretty scary.
Aiden was at his dad's house in the middle of doing a virtual interview for his friend's podcast when he saw people commenting his address on TikTok. Some of the comments included two lightning bolt emojis, which bear significant resemblance to the double lightning Nazi emblem worn on SS soldier uniforms during World War II. He saw a post with more lightning bolt emojis and threats from white supremacists spreading anti-Semitic hate messages. This was a different level of hate than he was used to.
Because I've gotten like death threats before. Those aren't like strange. And like I get slurs in my DMs, but not to the degree that people were like DMing me here and commenting hateful stuff on this post.
That's when Aiden anxiously started trying to reach his mom and brother. They were at his doxed address and weren't picking up their phones. He cut the podcast short and dashed to his mom's house.
In the car ride over, I was kind of having like a bit of a panic attack and I was crying.
He felt lucky to find his mom and brother just watching a movie, phones on silent. When his younger brother heard about the threats, he got scared.
And I think he later like threw up just because he was so stressed. But my mom and I like covered all the shades and like got out baseball bats from back when I was playing baseball just to be safe.
About 9 police officers filed in. The FBI also got involved, assigning an investigator who specializes in hate crimes. Aiden's mother, Lori Cohn, knows more than most people about this topic. She is a lawyer who works on domestic violence cases, and she's had many clients who've been doxxed, cyber-stalked, and cyber-harassed. She recognized they needed to get the authorities involved right away.
he's a teenager, it seemed really surprising to me that somebody would actually threaten a teenager through social media, and very unsettling when the threats came through.
So in the end, there were like a lot of people. And so like once there were like, I think like 8 or 9 police officers, I was like, I think I'll be fine even if someone does show up.
Aiden is one of hundreds of thousands who have gotten personal identifying information released online with threats to harm them. The rapid rise of information readily available on the internet, mixed with the political polarization in the US, creates a hotbed for online feuds that get real fast.
There's a whole campaign to really harass. It can be very scary and very overwhelming.
Dr. Gabriella Coleman is a professor at McGill University and author of several books about online hackers. She says social media has fueled the increase in doxing.
It's not just white supremacists. I mean, there's all sorts of groups that have often been behind doxing.
On TikTok, it's become common for some users to openly release sensitive information of others. Others share stories on TikTok of when they were doxed.
I have been doxed before, and it is one of the scariest experiences of my life.
Last night, all my personal information was shared to Reddit. I was called out as being a fraud. Myself, my family, my friends, we have been abused endlessly these past 24 hours.
I was getting hundreds of DMs and they were all saying, kill yourself, you're a terrible person. They're sending me my address and I was very confused.
While curiosity is what got a lot of users onto the app in 2020, it's the algorithm that keeps them there. It watches every move each user makes on the app to help understand what they like to see. And once it knows the user well enough, the content becomes pretty accurate. I asked TikTok users which side of TikTok they are on, and the possibilities were endless.
I have been doing a lot of soul searching these past few weeks. There are a lot of changes going on in my life, so I have slowly ended up on manifestation TikTok and positive energy TikTok.
I'm on music theory and producing TikTok.
I'm on Bad Bunny TikTok.
Fitness TikTok.
I'm on sports TikTok.
Joke about how single you are TikTok.
And on simp TikTok.
Black hair TikTok.
Leftist TikTok.
And burnout student TikTok.
Today, Aiden helps produce political content on a separate account called Gen Z for Change, which he co-founded. And he sarcastically jokes that he has to be more careful on his personal account.
I try to make videos that would piss Nazis off a little bit less.
In late February, 1 week after I spoke with Aiden for the first time, he was doxxed again. And again, his family had to bring in the authorities. In total, the police have reported to 3 calls to Aiden's home. How long did it take for you and Aiden to feel safe in your home?
I think we're still working on that. Every now and then the threats pop up again, and we're informed about them. So I wouldn't say that we feel altogether safe in our home.
One way they create some sort of peace of mind is to keep that old baseball bat around.
It was really sad. I kept it under my bed for a while just to be safe. And then like one day I was like, because it had been a couple months since I had gotten doxxed, I was like, I think I can finally put this away. And then that night I got doxxed again.
Each time a dangerous threat is received, the family alerts the detective and Aiden's account goes on private for a few days. The heightened safety precautions have become a new normal.
It has certainly changed, I think, our outlook and the way we live our lives.
Laws against cyber harassment are on the books in several states, and experts say police are getting more and more training in how to find and go after harassers. It's something that may be increasingly important as divisions in the real and online worlds grow and doxing becomes more common. I'm Elizabeth Islas.
You You are listening to Divided States, efforts to pull together when things fall apart. And while social media may be putting more people in more extreme camps, music has often been a bridge to help bring people together. To test that theory, a couple of violinists revved up a groovy VW van and hit the open road.
It's like somebody took them from some magical place and plonked them down there. There they were.
That's coming up. Stay with us. Thanks for joining us. This is Divided States, efforts to pull together when things fall apart. I'm Shirley Jihad. The Asian American community has come together in many ways to make their voices heard after anti-Asian hate crimes spiked during the pandemic, fueled by anti-Asian rhetoric.
COVID, to be specific, COVID-19. That name gets further and further away from China as opposed to calling it the Chinese virus. I can name Kung Flu.
The anti-Asian violence often hit the most vulnerable, the elderly, the poor, the linguistically isolated, and women. In light of this, a chorus of Asian American voices has risen to respond publicly and meet the new crisis.
We have lived in the shadows, invisible, overlooked, stereotyped, and relegated as second-class citizens.
Christine Kim tells us more.
Jimmy Bapensi thinks of himself as a fighter.
To be honest with you, I would die for this cause. That's just me, though. I would. I don't know. I just can't stop. I can't stop thinking about it. I dream about it. I literally dream about it. Like, every time I close my eyes, I'm dreaming about meeting new people.
Bapensi is 38 years old. His family is from Laos. He works 12-hour shifts, 6 days a week, as a contract local truck driver. When his shift is over, he heads to Chinatown in Oakland to start his nightly patrols.
It's a little quiet right now, but you know, we out here, though.
We're talking over Zoom.
Until all the stores close safely, you know what I'm saying?
He takes me along via his cell phone as he walks the streets.
That's what we're doing.
He's on one of his patrols, and we're along for the ride. He wasn't asked to do this work in the community. He says he just feels like he has to do it. As a patrol volunteer with the group Asians with Attitude, he makes sure stores close safely and the elderly are escorted and protected.
Take your time, okay? We walk slow, it's cool. Hey, what's going on?
And I can only imagine something happened to my grandma, like, it just triggered me. One is enough.
Jimmy's eyes are watchful. He's attentive to the streets and any possible confrontation. I ask him if he's ever encountered an incident while patrolling.
Might encounter one right now.
Bapensi brings his cell phone down as he walks towards someone.
Are you good? You good, bro? I'm on a Zoom call right now. Yeah, it's good.
He makes sure the older man is doing all right.
Yeah, it's all good.
Then comes back to me on the Zoom. I ask him what goes through his head while he's patrolling.
I can't be everywhere at once, so it's like a lot of stuff going through my mind, good and bad. There's so many stuff going on. Like I don't know what's going to happen. I don't know if they have a weapon or whatnot. I'm trying to de-escalate the problem, but things can happen. But, you know, the way I look at it is like this. I'm not going to allow nothing to happen anymore, not under my watch.
Bapensi has congestive heart failure. It's a serious condition. It landed him in the hospital recently. But still, he says he won't let it stop him from patrolling and rallying for the Asian elders and the community.
I won't stop till all this stops. And that's my word. I don't care if it takes a year, two, or three, or four.
It's a complicated experience being an Asian person living in America. Racism that the Asian American community is facing today is symptomatic of a long history of alienation, distrust, and persecution.
You could either be the model minority and insider, or the perpetual foreigner, the outsider. And in certain conditions, we're the model minority and we're crazy rich Asians and we're white adjacent and we're complicit in white supremacy.
Dr. Russell Jung is professor of Asian American Studies at San Francisco State University.
But in other conditions, we swing to being considered the outsider. In times of war, in times of pandemic, in times of economic downturn, we're the perpetual foreigner. And last year, we had all three conditions.
Jung is also co-founder of Stop AAPI Hate. It tracks self-reported cases of hate crimes against Asian Americans.
When people weren't wearing masks, Asians had to make the calculus. Should I wear a mask and get attacked for being a disease carrier, or do I not wear a mask and possibly get COVID? In 20% of our cases, people said it's because they were wearing a mask that they were facing discrimination.
Asian Americans across the country are standing in solidarity, confronting long hidden wounds and turning that into action.
One of my mentors now, Bosia, said this. This is when I was going through the storm. You need to let yourself feel all the emotions.
For Asian American leaders like Sam Hyun of Hate as a Virus, getting to positivity requires confronting some dark feelings.
He asked me like three times, are you angry? I was like, no. He goes, are you angry? I was like, no. Are you yes. He's like, go be angry. Are you sad? No. Are you sad? Yes. Go be sad too. I think everybody's at a different place. And we need to allow everybody to feel how they feel and go through those emotions. And so some of that's gonna lead to a protesting on the streets. Some of that is gonna lend itself to wanting to do something in terms of like changing policy.
But of course, it all matters. The pandemic era sparks not only the surge of anti-Asian hate and violence, but the community activism to confront it. Hate as a Virus has raised over $650,000 in donations. Sam Hyun believes it's the groundwork, the response that will be the true mark of this era.
It's going to take all of us to come together to really create the solutions that we need. And then it's not just about our community, then it's about fighting for other communities, all communities.
Jung agrees the solution lies within the Asian American community.
I actually mostly attribute it to Asian Americans rallying attention to the issue. And I think that's a good thing, actually. Because we've always experienced violence, and now our voices are being heard.
And it's people like activist Papensi who have taken that understanding into the streets.
Enough is enough! People say, oh, I was born to do this or something. I'm like, I'm not one of those educated person. I know how to speak, but I just speak my heart out. Like, I feel good. I feel like, especially when the energy is going, especially when the kids reaching out to me, thanking me, it keeps me going like on the daily when the kids say, thank you. Thank you, Jimmy. Thank you, JB.
I'm Christine Kim.
Music has always been key to bringing people together. And this is the story of Music Caravan, two violinists who hit the open road during the pandemic. Etienne Gara and his partner, Yuan Kim, overhauled a VW minibus, painted it candy apple red, and started driving through our divided states, bringing music to farmers, winemakers, and anyone they meet along the way, including turkeys and ostriches. Polina Cherizova has our story.
You know, it's like
jump. You play like Korean, I play like French.
Something. Yeah, it's just you play. Sometimes I complain that he plays too free. You know?
Yeah, I'm French.
And then he complains that I'm sometimes too square. You know?
She's correct.
But I'm being rhythmical.
Etienne and Yuan are concert violinists.
Etienne is the artistic director and founder of Delirium Musicum, a Los Angeles-based string orchestra. He is also the newly named artist in residence at the Soraya, a state-of-the-art venue in LA. While Ewan is an international competition winner with over 6 million views on YouTube. Their mission is simple, to bring joy and human bonding through music. And in a time when our states are more divided than ever, they believe music can bring us a little closer.
It's more that music is gonna save the world. We all have the same dreams, we all have the same worries, we all have the same, you know, everything in life, no matter what political, social, religious background you have. And it's about, you know, breaking that wall that we have and bond together and create stories.
Music Caravan emerged as a project of Delirium Musicum. But becoming traveling musicians on the road was far from what the two violinists had envisioned back in March of 2020. Delirium Musicum was in full swing. They were getting ready for tours, preparing for a recording session with a major record label, and they were just about to play a concert in Wallace Annenberg Center for the Performing Arts.
We're really looking forward to it.
Ticket was already like...
It was sold out.
Then the pandemic hit, and everything stopped. Concert halls suddenly went silent.
Concerts, sporting events, and festivals here in the Southland and across the country are being canceled or postponed.
Sad news tonight, the LA Philharmonic has canceled its concerts for the rest of the year. The decision follows the Hollywood Bowl, the Ford, and Walt Disney Concert Hall, which are all going dark due to the pandemic.
And then, you know, it was like, okay, we need to do something because, you know, you cannot just stop life. It's like, I still need to create, otherwise I cannot live.
From this isolation and necessity to create, an idea was born. What if they could still continue performing, but outdoors and socially distanced?
And then we started the courtyard concerts, right?
They began playing in the courtyard of their apartment building in East Hollywood every Sunday. The music brought people out of their homes. From the elderly to parents with children, all kinds of listeners stepped out onto their balconies to experience live music. Thank you, and stay safe, everyone. Then they thought, what if this could be something more? What if they could bring music to people all over America, not just Los Angeles?
How do we do that? It's like, we can't just do
it. But it's not that I never imagined that I'm gonna be living in a bus. When he talked about this idea, of course I thought it's crazy.
While searching on Craigslist, they scrolled through hundreds of vehicles until they found the one. A little 1971 VW bus. A vehicle with personality. The metal plates of the chassis were rusted, there were bumps and scratches, and the paint was faded. But after they tuned the engine, bought new curtains, and painted it bright red, it was ready.
It's extremely cute. People will come to you. It triggers imagination. It triggers stories because most people have a story about a VW bus about 50 years ago. And nobody can throw you out when they see this cute candy on wheel.
They named him Boris. And finally in August, they hit the road. It was the start of their own great American road trip. Two violinists from foreign countries, traveling across the states from one place to the next, trying to bring people together.
I never thought about it as me being French or not from here. I always felt it that I'm coming to people. They don't know my background, I don't know their background, but I see them just as people.
Meeting people along the way has given them a sense of place in America.
Where do I belong? You know, French, I'm a Hungarian, I'm American, I'm European, where do I really come from, where do I go? It became like normal to be the foreigner, to be on the road.
For Yuen, being on the road helped her cope with grief.
Because of what happened to my father and stuff.
Like so many others in 2020, her dad passed away last year, just as they started their trip.
The beginning was very hard, but it was more helpful for me to travel and meet new people and then this crazy time on the road.
There's a kind of freedom in not knowing where the road will take them next. from cinematic landscapes, across deserts, through forests.
And the forest, redwood forest, and these huge trees, and you go up and down. And
the morning, you have the sun coming up.
Like, oh my God, this is like so beautiful and stunning. And at the same time, I'm so small, you know, compared to this earth. I'm nothing. I really like that feeling. The faucet is almost really tiny, really, really tiny. There's a small sink, there's a water tank, and we have a small ice box. We store our food.
People gave us meat from their farm. It's like we butchered an old rooster that we made coq au vin with it, which is, you know, rooster that you cook for very long in wine.
Bon appétit.
It's a French dish. Bon appétit. It's like, you know, Michelin star restaurant just in a bus.
Their bus has taken them from farms, groves, and vineyards to a Christian Orthodox monastery on an island in Washington. Along the road, they've met all kinds of people, from Trump supporters to Americans on the liberal side to war veterans and hippies who traveled in VW buses years ago. People from all political, religious, and social backgrounds have welcomed Yuen and Etienne into their homes.
They open their door no matter what. They hear our story, what we're doing at this time, and they immediately feel that, oh, I need to do something good too.
You know, in Napa, that our driveway hosts were pro-Trump, and then we invited to the garden concert people who were just a block away, who were VW people, so pretty much old hippies. Yeah. They were both surprised to find themselves, you know, in the same place. But hey, it was courteous, it was nice. They all enjoyed each other. And I think they saw that, you know, we're human beings before everything.
From Oceanside, California, they drove north through Ventura County, heading towards the farms outside of Ojai, 80 miles north of LA. They parked Boris between vast groves of citrus, walnut, and olive trees near the farm of the Ojai Olive Oil Company.
So last year was a huge season, absolutely humongous.
Yeah.
After 14 years of working in the classical music industry in Los Angeles, Alice Asquith moved to Ojai, where she eventually got involved with the family business.
And this year's gonna be very small. So an olive doesn't contain
amidst the olive trees in a little canyon by a pond, Etienne and Yuen set up their music stands.
So for the next song,
and played for a little audience
of
five.
Poland, but not that far from France because he's from Chopin and he loved to be seen as French.
Yes, he did.
And it's Nocturne, Opus 9, number 2.
It's like somebody took them from some magical place and plonked them down there. And there they were. And they could have been anywhere. You know, it was about music. That's all it was. It was about music. And of course, down at the grove, they could hear them. So everybody stopped and listened, you know. And they all said the same thing. It was like time stopped.
I felt free out there. Free. Flying.
Really enjoyed your music very much.
Thank you so much. I love this.
Very good.
If we play with our heart, then they will love it, whatever we play.
So it gives really faith in humanity. People are compassionate, people are respectful, people have dreams. And when you put all this together, it's pretty amazing to be alive.
Although Music Caravan began as a response to a deadly pandemic, Etienne and Yuen say they're just getting started.
So I'm wondering, you know, if we don't have those barriers because of the pandemic, then can we go even further? You know, can we have 50 people, you know, in their backyards instead of three?
It feels like it's in the continuity of what was meant to do. And maybe with more musicians, you know, like have a real music caravan with many buses and many musicians following and
that just would be so cool.
Playing outside randomly.
The Little Red Bus has taken Etienne and Yuen from Southern California all the way to the Canadian border. But one thing remains constant: the music and the power it has in bringing people together. I'm Paulina Cherizova.
This is Divided States, stories of efforts to pull together when things fall apart. Thanks so much for listening. Our producers are Johnny Dorsal and Paulina Cherizova. Our sound engineer is Allison Wolf. Our editors are Sandy Tolan and myself, Shirley Jihad. Kareem Joseph Karam composed much of the music you heard this hour. Check out our podcast called The Listening Well. Find it wherever you get your podcasts. Our stories come to you thanks to the USC Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
You are tuned in to listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
Did you miss the Soul and Hip Hop Marathon on Juneteenth weekend? No worries. You can go to kboo.fm/